Wading the water, come on and wade in the water, children, wade.
Large areas of the country, including the upper Midwest, have seen their lakes and rivers drop to low levels because of drought. Well, Mother Nature has turned that around in some places, and that's one of the subjects coming up during Jet Streaming.
In the water, come on and wade. In the water, children, wade.
Oh, that's good music. I'm Kathy Werzer, the host of Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio, along with meteorologist Paul Huttner and climatologist Mark Seely. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Kathy. Good morning.
Good morning, Kathy.
Good to see you. And now we're going to talk about the really humid weather of late in the upper Midwest and what high dew points say about climate change. But first, let's talk about how parts of the Midwest are recovering from the drought.
Well, and you may remember earlier this summer, one of our famous Minnesota landmarks, Minnehaha Falls, actually ran dry in Minneapolis for a while. Lake and river levels dropped quite a bit this summer. Joining us with an update is Mike Wyatt. He's with the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, and they just opened the dam at Grays Bay on Lake Minnetonka for the first time since July 18th. Mike, welcome to Jet Streaming.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I see you opened the Grays Bay Dam this weekend. Maybe you didn't do it specifically, but Minnehaha Creek is flowing again. No doubt Minnehaha Falls is roaring once again. What prompted the decision to open the dam, and who makes that call?
Well, the dam operation is guided by a plan which was put together by the Watershed District and then approved by the Department of Natural Resources. And the basic idea behind the plan is that in the summertime, when the lake levels get high, we discharge water into Minnehaha Creek, and that provides the base flow for the creek, which goes all the way down the creek to, over the falls down to the river. And then in the fall, we try to bring the lake down to a certain level to allow for spring runoff and snow melt. So we want to have a little bit of capacity in Lake Minnetonka. So when that water runs off in the spring and we start to get our spring rains, that people aren't getting flooded out. So it's kind of a cyclical process. The lake rises in the early summer and then drops down in the fall.
Mike, Mark Seely, I wanted to ask, since we're so emphatically in this trend for wetness now, starting October the way we did, it's conceivable we could have the wettest combination in history of August, September, October precipitation. How deeply into the fall do you think you'll have this situation as far as letting things flow there?
Well, we'll discharge until we get the lake down about to the level where it was in July. So, assuming that we don't get much rain, the lake will drop about 3 or 4 inches a week at the level that's flowing out of the lake right now. If it keeps raining, we'll keep discharging water, and that's exactly what happened back in 2002, and it was about this time of year back then when we had record high water levels on Lake Minnetonka. And it was a similar situation, fall rains that just kept coming and kept coming. And it wasn't really large rain events, but just a lot of small rain events that kept dumping water consistently into the lake, and the lake kept rising, and the creek kept flowing too. And we were not so sure whether or not we were going to hit our mark that year as far as how far we wanted to draw the lake down. But we eventually did, and it happened around the end of November or December, which is really unusual for us.
By the way, I'm curious, how dry did it get earlier this year?
Well, as you know, we didn't get much rain from about May through July, so basically, we were able, we did start the year with high lake levels, so we were able to discharge water into the creek until July, but then we kind of reached that threshold point in July where we were obligated under our plan to basically shut the dam off. So usually that tends to happen in September or October, but this year, just with the lack of rain, it ended up happening in July.
Mike, a lot of folks may not know what is a watershed district. Why do they exist? And I'm curious, do you Do you have competing interests, the lake owners, the folks and the communities along the creek? Do they want to see different things happen on Minnehaha Creek?
Oh, you bet. Well, you know, we're dealing with some really iconic resources and really important ones to the metro area for recreation and also just for the ecology within the metro area as well. But the reason that our watershed district was created was all watershed districts are created through petition by citizens who live within the area. And the watershed is basically all the water flows to a specific point. And in our case, it's Minnehaha Creek. And there were several people on Minnehaha Creek back in the 1960s who petitioned to have this watershed district established. And what was happening was there was an old weir at Lake Minnetonka, which is just basically a dam that's more or less a sheet pile dam. And what would happen in the wintertime is with the freeze-thaw cycle, snow would melt, flow over the dam, and then flow over the ice on Minnehaha Creek because it was frozen, and flow all the way down to Edina where it would hit some ice dams and then spread out into people's neighborhoods. And so it was those people who were getting flooded out that actually started the petition to create a watershed district. And one of our first major efforts was to create an adjustable dam on Lake Minnetonka. And part of the operation of that dam calls for it to be shut down in the wintertime to prevent that flooding from happening. So we were successful in that, and we've kind of broadened our scope as an organization over time, and we're actually celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, and we're kind of running the gamut now of all water management issues from flooding issues to water quality management to even getting into management of ecology along Minnehaha Creek and within the lakes.
Mike, just a comment for you. I really am with you all the way in terms of establishing more control on that watershed. It appears as though all the science evidence is pointing at higher variability in our hydrologic systems in Minnesota. So I think your ability to have better control on that watershed is a very, very wise move for the future.
Well, and you know, no one really knows what the future holds with global warming and what effects that's going to happen, as you know, Dr. Seeley, on our climate here. So we're, you know, anticipating that we're going to have to adapt our management in the future to accommodate things like very heavy rain events and these this variability in the climate where we have really dry summers, which is, I mean, typically June and July are our wettest time of year, and this year it was, you know, one of our driest times of year. So it's been really interesting to see that variability play itself out, and you know, we take it as it comes and try to adjust accordingly.
All right, Mike, good conversation. Thanks so much.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Mike Wyatt with the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
Você sabe o que é caviar? Nunca vi nem comi, eu só ouço falar. Você sabe o que é caviar? Nunca vi nem comi, eu só ouço falar.
Oh, that's a little tropical music there. Folks in places like Florida, Georgia, Mississippi are used to tropical conditions, high dew points and humidity levels. The upper Midwest can also get pretty humid during the summer. What's unusual is seeing dew points well into the 70s during October, and that got us to wondering whether high dew points are indicative of climate change. Now, we are really pleased that Dr. Ben Santer from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory at the University of California is with us. Dr. Santer is here to talk about his research into atmospheric water vapor. He's also a past author of IPCC research on climate change. Dr. Santer, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
What do we know about the moisture content in the atmosphere? Has it increased significantly?
It has. We published a paper a couple of weeks ago where we looked at satellite records that are available since 1988 from a series of satellites that have flown an instrument called the Special Sensing Microwave Imager. And those records show that there's been a pronounced increase in the total amount of water vapor over the world's oceans since 1988. And that increase is pretty much what we expect to see as the world warms through human-caused increases in greenhouse gases.
Ben, I wanted to ask, I did, by the way, read your paper, and I found it very interesting. You alluded to a 6 to 7.5% increase in specific humidity, but I wondered if the detail was such that you could say a few more things about, say, latitudinal distribution. Has there been relatively greater increase in mid to high latitudes, say, versus low latitudes, or did you tease out any detail like that?
Yeah, we did. This satellite actually does provide information on the pattern of water vapor changes latitudinally. And what we found was that the largest increases, absolute increases in water vapor, were in the warmest places, particularly over the world's tropical oceans. And that's pretty much expected through this relationship called the Clausius-Clapeyron relationship. We expect to see the biggest bang for your buck, if you will, in terms of the water vapor changes where it's warmest. And that's what we saw in both the satellite observations and in the results from computer models that had been run with human-caused changes in greenhouse gases. So one of the features of our paper was this fingerprint match, if you will. There was a nice pattern correspondence between the way the pattern of real-world water vapor had actually changed and what climate models, what computer models told us should have happened in response to human influences.
So water vapor in itself is a greenhouse gas?
That's right, and that's one of the concerns in part. Water vapor is a potent greenhouse gas. Our best understanding of the physics is that as we burn oil, coal, natural gas, and release greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we warm the surface of the planet and the lower atmosphere. Some of that warming goes into evaporation and increases the amount of water vapor that the atmosphere can hold. Water vapor in itself is a greenhouse gas, so that amplifies the warming caused by the carbon dioxide, and that's what we call a feedback, a positive feedback. And showing that that operates is sort of interesting scientifically, but not so interesting in terms of people and the real world, because we're showing that there's an amplifying mechanism that will act to increase the amount of warming that we would get just due to carbon dioxide alone.
Dr. Santer, Paul Huttner here. You've been working with the satellite measurements of water vapor back to the late 1980s. Are you aware of any longer-term studies on the variability of water vapor in the atmosphere, say, from ice cores or seafloor sediments? And, you know, how much would we expect the total amount of water vapor to vary over long periods of time in the atmosphere?
That's a good question, Paul. I don't know whether I can give you an informed answer to that. There are longer-term measurements of water vapor in the atmosphere from weather balloons that extend back, in some cases, to the 1960s, late 1950s. Those have a lot of problems because the instrumentation for measuring water vapor in the atmosphere has actually changed over time. Now, on longer timescales, looking back, as you say, in sediment cores and ice cores, I'm not quite sure whether there are direct measurements of water vapor, but I guess one could probably make inferences about the amount of water vapor because there's a pretty tight correlation between temperature changes and water vapor changes, particularly in the tropics.
In differentiating the signature change land versus ocean, Ben, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you to comment a little bit. There's been some studies that I've read, notably in the Midwest, that suggest that American agriculture, as it's evolved in terms of the genetic selection of crops we grow, has produced a landscape with a more intense transpiration stream into the boundary layer during the summer growing season. And I wondered, do you buy the hypothesis, and granted this is probably simply a working hypothesis, that this may contribute be contributing to some of the high water vapor values, notably the dew points, that have been measured in recent decades in the Midwest?
It is clear from a paper that's going to be published in Nature this week that looks at surface humidity changes over land primarily, that there is some signal over many land areas around the world. Over the last 50 years, there has been a significant increase in surface-specific humidity. And the authors of this paper in Nature show that the best explanation for that observed increase in surface humidity does involve human-caused changes in greenhouse gases. But I find it certainly plausible that large-scale changes in land use could also have a signature in surface humidity. We know in California, in the Central Valley, that there has been a widespread change and increase in irrigation over time, particularly in the summer months. And it does look from a variety of climate computer model studies and observational studies as if that change in irrigation has had a real impact on summertime maximum temperatures, so has actually obscured the irrigation has, we think, a net cooling effect and has obscured some of the greenhouse warming signal we would otherwise have seen in locations like the Central Valley of California. So could irrigation and changes in crop types also have some signature in surface humidity? I certainly find that plausible.
Following up on that, there was a recent paper by David Noon, John Warden, and others alluding to the isotopic signatures of water vapor and our ability to differentiate water vapor in the atmosphere that may have had oceanic origin versus water vapor in the atmosphere that may have had landscape origin. This intrigues me, and you being an expert on the models, Ben, I just wonder, do you think we might get to the day where we could differentiate the source of water vapor that had led to some precipitation event over a given area?
Hmm. Yes. Wow. A number of groups are actively working on the problem of trying to incorporate isotopes and isotopic information as tracers in climate models. I know the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, GIS, in New York, has been working on that problem for quite a while. I believe also scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder have been trying to put isotopes in their climate model. And if one could do that, then that would offer the intriguing possibility of trying to figure out sources and sinks for things like precipitation.
That is intriguing. Well, Dr. Santer, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
And many thanks to Dr. Santer, who's with the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, for taking time out to talk with us. We've been talking about his research into atmospheric water vapor. By the way, Mark Seely, wasn't the good doctor a past KNAST lecturer at the U of M?
He was. In fact, he was here for our 10th anniversary event, a rather large event where we had quite a forum discuss climate change. And I might add that Dr. Santer is extremely prolific researcher as well as a world recognized authority in this field. So we were quite privileged to have him on.
Now, this coming jet streaming, we hope, fingers and toes crossed, that we'll have this year's KNAST lecturer, perhaps.
Yes, Dr. Kerry Emanuel from MIT, who wrote the book The Divine Wind, a scientific bestseller about hurricanes and the history of hurricanes, will be hopefully our guest next week.
That would be very interesting. It's also, you know, as we talk about our high dew point readings here recently in October, your question was interesting about, because we've talked about this before, about corn, you know, the agricultural plants maybe adding more water vapor into the atmosphere. And it was interesting to see what he had to say about that.
Yes, it's interesting that that paper's coming out in Nature. I'm going to pay careful attention to that.
I knew you would.
Because the human signature may not be embedded in solely our greenhouse gas emissions. The human signature on climate change may also be embedded in the genetics we choose to grow for crops.
All right. Hey, the things you learn here in Jet Streaming.
Fascinating stuff.
We cannot leave without a weather website of the week. And it's my turn. I use this one a lot, actually. Have you heard of this? UM Weather from the University of Michigan? Tons of information there. Tons, including a weather software archive. Paul Huttner, you computer weather geek, you.
Nice.
Yes.
You'll have to check that one out.
You have to, yes. It's the largest and most up-to-date selection of weather software on the internet. I don't think you have to pay for it necessarily. With these applications, you can create high-resolution radar maps, and you can access new weather services on the net or even track hurricanes all by your little lonesome down your basement.
I've got to check that out, too. I have not seen that.
Well, I can't even begin to give you the URL right here because it's really long. But we'll post it at minnesotapublicradio.org. Check out Jet Streaming for that. It's an interesting one, but it comes from the University of Michigan. Gentlemen, Paul's already typing that into the computer.
They even have weather cams. You can just go look at weather on different parts of the world.
We should have our own weather cam here in studio. Maybe that's not good to have people see what we look like.
No, I don't think so.
Probably not good. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. I think next week should be fun, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Mark, thank
you. Pleasure to be with you, Kathy.
As always, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for Jet Streaming for the week. Thank you for joining us, and don't be shy. Send us a note with a question or a comment at minnesotapublicradio.org. By the way, thank you to Sarah Fleener for helping to produce Jet Streaming. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky. Keep on